Where are you from? No, where are you really from? I hate that question. It assumes I'm not from here, and I already know what they want me to say. You know who I mean. Plus, my real answer is kind of complicated. But if I really have to say something, I usually say this. I was born in Los Angeles, but grew up in Manila, Kuala Lumpur, and the Bay Area. Yep, complicated. I was 15 years old when I moved back to the US. Even though my family took trips to the States, it felt like we were going there for the first time. When my dad told me we were moving, I was nervous, but also really excited. I daydreamed about what I thought my life would be like. Remember, this was before social media, and I was 15. Anything and everything I knew about American life came from books like Nancy Drew, magazines like 17, and of course, American movies and TV. I loved Hey Arnold, Clarissa Explains It All, basically anything on Nickelodeon. As for movies, I watched a lot of things. Disney, The Godfather, and I couldn't get enough of 90s teen comedies. My all-time fave? She's All That. In this high school Cinderella story, nice guy jock Zach Seiler makes a bet he can turn the weird girl, Lainey Boggs, into a popular prom queen.
What, Lainey Boggs? No.
Hey, a bet's a bet, bro, right, Preston?
Hey, man, this is between you guys.
Zach is played by 90s teen heartthrob Freddie Prinze Jr., and Lainey is Rachel Lee Cook, who really doesn't look nerdy or weird or whatever, but I guess she fits that description here. She wears glasses.
What is this, some kind of new dork outreach program? I'm just...
No, if... Are you always like this?
No.
Yes.
Lainey Boggs, get your cute butt down here!
This movie has it all. Romance, betrayal, a dance sequence, and a most iconic makeover reveal. You know, the one where Lainey goes down the stairs to meet Zach before the big party. Instead of glasses, she's wearing a short red dress and high heels. She floats down the steps like a teen dream. Until...
Ready?
Yeah.
Ideal version of my then 15-year-old life. Well, sort of. Okay, so I'm not saying that I totally 100% believed American life was just like in the movies and TV. But in a way, I sort of wished it would be. And I kind of thought it might be. And when I finally packed up my bags and flew 7,000 miles to make a foreign country my new home, I really, really wanted it to be. But maybe I shouldn't have watched so much film and television. In real life, high school is awkward and hard. Well, at least for me. Imagine moving to a new high school in a new country. Your emo teenage problems are multiplied by 1,000. I remember just after moving to San Ramon, a small suburb of the San Francisco Bay Area, my mom and I met with a high school guidance counselor, and he talked to me funny. Like I didn't speak English. I spoke it fluently. A student called me a fob, F-O-B, fresh off the boat. Whether it was a joke or not, it wasn't funny when I found out what that implied. I felt like I didn't fit in, because all the cool girls were white girls, and they all wore thongs that peeked out of their low-rise jeans, trucker hats, and extra-thick black eyeliner. I didn't. And when I met my first friend, I panicked. She was white. And I was worried about how I'd find her the next day, because, honestly, all the white people looked exactly the same to me. If my high school life were a movie, I was not Lainey Boggs. There was no makeover scene or a high school Prince Charming waiting in the wings. I was uncredited extra. Moving to a new country is lonely, weird, hard, kind of funny, and I'm not the only person who's done it. Picture leaving everything you ever knew. Your home, your best friends, the weather you're used to, the food you love, the things you see every day to start a new life in a new land with a whole new culture you thought you knew about, but turns out you know nothing at all. What's that like? How would you survive? And would you stay? I'm Paula Mardo, and this is Long Distance, Filipino audio stories set a long way from home. On this podcast, I want to find out, what does it mean to be Filipino outside of the homeland? To grow up there and have to leave it? Or what if you've never been there at all? The Philippines has one of the largest diaspora populations in the world, and most of those people are in the United States. So this season, you'll hear about forgotten histories and true tales of Filipino Americans. I want to know about our connections or disconnections to the homeland and to each other. Is there something new we can learn from our varied experiences? Is there something I can learn about my own experience through all this? Once a month, over the next couple months, we'll get into all that and more. And who knows? I might even share a little bit about what happened to me after those first few months of high school culture shock. Or not. Anyway, since this is the first episode, I guess I should explain how this is all gonna work. Each episode will start with a short story or interview or anecdote that introduces a theme or an idea for the main story you'll be hearing the rest of the show. Today's introduction, which you just heard, is this super awkward short version story about me coming to America. So this next story you'll be listening to is kind of about that too. But instead of me, it's about some of the very first Filipinos who moved here and paved the way for future generations. Who were they? Why did they leave their homeland? What was that like? Before we get into all that past, we start in the present. In a community built by the descendants of those first Filipino Americans. Something unexpected and kind of shocking happened to them about a year ago. A reminder of what their own ancestors went through decades before. And so I went there to learn about what happened and why. What I found was a story about history, dark truths, and resilience. On this episode, Little Manila, Part 1. So we're on the way to Stockton, and we're trying to figure out if we're in Stockton yet. So I'm with Patrick. He's here. He's holding the mic as I'm driving. What do you think, Patrick?
I thought we were in Stockton already, but I've never been here. I lived.
Hey, El Dorado Street. I think that's El Dorado Street exit. I think that's a street in Stockton. I've heard of it.
Okay. Well, that's evidence enough for me.
It's late morning. I'm on the road to Stockton, California, with Patrick, my partner, boyfriend, really whatever flat. You want to call it.
What does it look like to you? Can you describe what you're seeing?
Yeah, it's a lot of strip malls, like very small buildings in terms of height, a lot of smog. I always knew that kind of closer to the Central Valley, the smog kind of collects and just kind of sits, but
How do you know that?
I'm pretty smart. Nah.
That was a joke. Patrick and I get along pretty well. We're similar in a lot of ways. We both lived in the Bay, moved to LA to work in film. We crack jokes. We're both Filipino-American. And we both like anchovies. We grew up differently, though. I lived almost half my life in the Philippines. He's only been there once. He was born and raised in the Bay. I only lived there in high school. He's a filmmaker and actor. I do radio now. Plus, I'm really more of a sweet tooth, and he's a salty kind of guy. Going to Stockton is a first for both of us. We don't have friends, family, or business there, so it's not really a place we visit. It's not a big metropolis like San Francisco or LA. It's kind of far out, surrounded by mostly farmland and factories. But there's a reason we're heading there right now.
Stockton police are still looking for the person responsible for defacing a popular community center where culture, history, and heritage is celebrated.
Kababayans from Stockton, California were shocked to find out that their Little Manila Center was vandalized.
Racially charged words were painted on the center's window and the historic photographs were torn apart.
Students posted pictures on social media and got the attention of the mayor and the police, who are investigating the vandalism as a hate crime.
A few months before, a Filipino-American community center in Stockton called the Little Manila Center was vandalized. This was in October, on Filipino-American History Month, just a few months after the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, amid seething racial tensions across the country. My social media feeds were filled with news articles and burning with angry face emojis. Here's what happened. A group of high school students arrived at the center for a cultural dance practice. Instead of tinikling sticks, they found torn up posters and a message scrawled on a window. While waiting for their teachers, some of the students started posting about it on social media. One of them was Celine Corpus. She posted a series of photos with tweets like, "Things like this make me so mad. Destroyed our donated pictures and messed up our windows and called us bigots. This is a hate crime." She also tweeted about how the police didn't show up, but later I learned her tweets got the mayor's attention and eventually the police. When Brian Batugo, the arts program director, arrived, he posted a Facebook Live video. The caption read, "Possible hate crime at the Little Manila Center." I'm going to play a clip from that video. Heads up, it's filmed with a cell phone, so the sound isn't great. Brian's on a sidewalk in front of the building. There's some background noise and music. He reads the message on the window. It looks like chicken scratch, as if whoever wrote it was in a hurry or just had really bad handwriting.
It's really, really sad, given that there was also a message written on the window. It seems to say, "You're the prop, Whitey. You're a brainwashed bigot." This is a suspected hate crime right now, and we're not really sure what to do. We called the police, and they're going to be coming to file a report. Unfortunately, our donated posters, our donated window banners that were designed are all ruined.
The banners hang from the top of these tall windows. They have images of notable Stockton Filipinos on them. They're all torn up, some worse than others. After seeing this, I had a lot of questions. Who did it? What was the Little Manila Center? Was this a hate crime? I couldn't find anything that dug deeper into what happened. So I got in touch with the center. Their co-founder and executive director got back to me. His name is Dylan Delvo. And he invited me to come to Stockton. All right, so Stockton has had its ups and downs over the years. In 2012, Stockton was the largest American city to file for bankruptcy as a result of the 2008 financial crisis and years of city leaders mismanaging funds. It exited bankruptcy in 2015, and these days, its young mayor, Michael Tubbs, is making waves with ambitious programs and policies like basic income. That's how I knew about Stockton. Now, Patrick told me he knew about Stockton in the 90s because of a band from there called
Pavement.
Darling, don't you go and cut your hair. What do you like about Pavement?
They just had really good music, and I like their lo-fi sound. It sounded really kind of stripped down and bare, you know, very 90s. Pavement.
Okay. Obviously, Stockton was around long before indie rock. Indigenous natives lived in the Central Valley, where Stockton sits today, years before the town was founded, during the California Gold Rush. Its place next to the San Joaquin River, about 90 miles inland from the San Francisco Bay, made it a perfect shipping point for Northern California products. Centered in the San Joaquin Valley, it was a booming city with prospects in entertainment and agriculture in the 1920s and 1930s. And for some reason, it was a place many of the first Filipino Americans went, a place where Little Manila was made. I didn't know too much about Little Manila before going to Stockton, but what I did know was that at one point it was home to the largest population of Filipinos outside of the Philippines. I wanted to know how that happened, why that happened, and what was going on there now. I park near the center and we walk up. I ask Patrick to take photos. The street is pretty empty, but there's some background noise from nearby construction work.
Oh my gosh, look. You can see the broken glass. Or is that glass?
No, those are ripped.
Oh, that's the posters. They're ripped. Yeah. And oh, look, over on this side. It's still here. Oh my gosh. More ripped up posters, and then we can see the writing on the window here. This is the vandalism. Can you read what it says?
I can't actually read that. White, wait.
For the record, it is hard to read. But 2 months after the incident, the ripped up posters and chicken scratch writing, it's all still here. Why? I ring the doorbell. Dylan Delvo opens the door. Hi, are you Dylan?
I am.
Hey, I'm Paula.
Nice to meet you, Paula.
Nice to meet you. This is Patrick.
Dylan's
a cheerful guy. He wears a button-down shirt with sneakers and a big smile. We walk inside, and I ask,
so some of the writing's still there. I didn't realize.
Yeah, we haven't done anything to it. Yet.
Wow.
No.
What did it say?
Oh, sorry. I just ate.
It's okay.
We're a little early, or maybe just not on Filipino time.
It said, hold on, let me see. I can't remember.
Because we tried to read it, and it's a little
it says,
hard.
Are you the prop, Whitey? You're a brainwashed bigot. That's what it says.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Also poorly spelled.
Poorly spelled and makes no sense. What's a prop, Whitey, and a brainwashed bigot? Was this a hate crime? I have a lot of questions. But before I can ask, Dylan shows us around, and there's plenty to see. We're standing in front of what looks like a replica of a small wooden room. It's got a cot and dresser, old clothes and shoes, books and photos, a typewriter, an old bottle of bourbon, and a portrait of a beautiful Filipino woman.
So what are we looking at right now?
Yeah.
Can you describe some of this stuff?
What you're seeing right now is kind of this recreation of what maybe asparagus camp bunk house would look like.
And why asparagus camp again?
Yeah, so Stockton at one point was kind of the asparagus capital of the world.
As early as 1906, a wave of mostly young Filipino men were recruited to the U.S. I'm talking teenagers and 20-somethings, brought to Hawaii to work sugar plantations as contract laborers or cicadas. Then they went to the mainland, mostly to various parts of California, to work the agricultural fields.
So Filipinos were migrant laborers, and so when you were coming into Stockton, you're here to work asparagus.
And that was a tough job, right? It wasn't easy.
Oh, yeah. So you're talking about like 10 to 12 hours in the fields, stoop labor with your back bent.
And when you say stoop labor, you just mean like...
Yeah, you would be slightly bent at an angle, like maybe 45 degrees with a long kind of knife thrusting down into the earth and cutting the asparagus. And then you would just move on to the next, over and over again for many, many, many hours. You know, I was old enough to kind of catch the last generation of manongs and manangs, and many of them walked, you know, in that position, kind of frozen where the back at an angle forward, bow-legged.
Asparagus farming, lettuce cutting, grape picking, these were just some of the migrant farm worker jobs done by manongs and manangs in California. The word manong or manang is a term of endearment for an older member of the family in the dialect Ilocano. It can mean older brother or older sister or even uncle or aunt. It's also a term used to describe that first big wave of Filipino immigrants in America, the pioneers, the manong generation, who left friends and families and sold all their possessions for a one-way boat ride to the American dream, only to find reality was far from what they expected. That's after the break. And now, a word from our sponsors. Just kidding, there are none. But if you're interested in sponsoring Long Distance, send an email to hello@longdistanceradio.com. Your sponsorship will help keep this show going and make deeply reported and produced audio stories about the Filipino diaspora possible. Plus, you'll reach an audience of truly awesome people. Right, guys? Cool. Now back to the show.
So now here, this is the idea of this is like you're coming into Little Manila, right? Our historic site. So we have a recreation, a huge picture of the intersection of Lafayette and El Dorado streets.
Is this in Little Manila? So like the center of it, right?
Yes. So much of this was destroyed.
Patrick takes pictures while Dylan and I gaze at a large black and white photograph of the original Little Manila neighborhood, which the center is named after. It's about a mile from where we're standing right now, but it doesn't exist anymore. Not the way it used to. Demolished and replaced by a freeway, McDonald's, and a gas station. On the photo is a passage by the writer Carlos Bulosan, who landed in America in 1930.
Do you want me to read what it's...
Yeah, please.
So Carlos Bulosan writes, as he's coming into Stockton, El Dorado Street, they said. It was like a song, for the words actually mean the land of gold. I did not know that I wanted gold in the new land, but the name was like a song. I walked slowly in the streets, avoiding the business district and the lights. Then familiar signs glowed in the coming night, and I began to walk faster. I saw many Filipinos in magnificent suits standing in front of pool rooms and gambling houses. I walked eagerly among them, looking into every face and hoping to see a familiar one. The asparagus season was over, and most of the Filipino farmhands were in town, bent on spending their earnings because they had no other place to go. You know, this was what Little Manila was. I mean, if you were a Filipino coming into America, you knew to go to Stockton. It was one of the few places in America where Filipinos could live this idea of America that they believed, you know, thanks to American colonists in the Philippines. And of course, Hollywood. You know, that's why when they come to America, they want to dress in suits. They want to, you know, this is what they understand of America.
Carlos Bulosan wrote about these early Filipinos in America, about his own experiences as one of them. Like many Filipinos at the time, he came to the U.S. in search of the American dream. Many thought they'd find it in Stockton. Why is that? Legend has it, a Filipino man known as Villarreal jumped ship at the port of San Francisco in 1898. He made his way to Stockton, worked on the railroads, harvested fruit. It was chill. Basically, he was like,
"Hey man, Stockton's pretty great."
So when he would meet other Filipinos in San Francisco, he'd say,
"Dude, you gotta check this place out."
Okay, maybe those weren't his exact words. Thanks, Patrick.
No problem.
But Villarreal was like Stockton's biggest fan. Stockton got so popular for Filipinos because they had heard it was the land of opportunity. It was El Dorado. Okay, so Filipinos have a long history of coming to America. And this tradition of leaving the homeland in search of opportunity in a foreign one began way before the Manongs. To understand this a little better, we have to go back in time, to the moment everything changed. Patrick's here to help again.
What's up?
As we travel back to 1521. Picture this. You're living your life in your own land. It's peaceful and happy for the most part.
Sarap.
Then someone comes along and takes everything away.
Wait, what?
An explorer named Ferdinand Magellan arrives and basically Columbuses the Philippines for the Spanish Empire, a major global power. A local ruler named Lapu-Lapu is not having it. And he's like,
"Who the hell is this?"
He's a total badass. And he kills Magellan, which delays Spanish occupation for 40 years. But the Spaniards make their way back. And they take over. They colonize the Philippine Islands for over 300 years. So, what do you do when life just sucks and you're a slave in your own land? You find a way. When the Spaniards launch the galleon trade, which brings products and spices from Manila to Acapulco, Filipinos work the ships as sailors and slaves. In 1587, a ship carrying Filipinos land near what we now know as Morro Bay, California. The Filipinos, known as the Luzon Indios, are like,
"Wow! Maganda!"
They try to take over, but they're attacked by natives, so that doesn't really last for very long.
Oh, damn.
In 1763, a group of Spanish-speaking Filipinos jump ship and settle in the bayous of Louisiana, and they live there forever. So you start thinking, maybe you can leave someday too. Then the Spanish-American War begins. At the same time, Filipinos launch a revolution against their Spanish colonizers. Revolutionary leaders like Andres Bonifacio lead the charge.
Hey, yo, you want to join the revolution? Here's a flyer. We're called the Katipunan.
Under the Treaty of Paris in 1898, Spain cedes its territories Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines to America. Meanwhile, Philippine General Emilio Aguinaldo declares the country's independence.
Suck it.
But Spain and the United States do not recognize this.
Oh, come on.
A bloody Philippine-American war ensues. You're captive again.
Dude, seriously?
The Americans open public schools, teach you English. It's the so-called white man's burden. But thing is, after all that, you want to go to school. You've been through enough. You want to take a chance on America. Like this guy.
I was in intermediate school. They were lecturing in a school to Miss Murphy. She's an Irish girl. And Mrs. Jackson and Miss Huff. And they were lecturing in America, you know. Blah, blah, this, blah, blah. This. My God. Must be paradise over there. In my mind, it is someday I'm going to be there. If it takes me my lifetime, I'm going to be there.
That's from the 1978 documentary film Manong by Linda Mabalot. She spoke to old Manongs when they reached their twilight years. In my research, I came across a lot of stories like this, and it seems like Little Manila was almost like a dream. If you walked around in the 1920s and 1930s, you'd see Filipino businesses like barbershops, shoe shiners, pool halls, and restaurants. You'd hear a variety of Filipino dialects, mostly Ilocano, Visayan, and Tagalog. You'd see Manongs posing on street corners, dressed to the nines, like spiffy brown Clark Gables. The Manong version of the American dream.
See if I can peel off another layer of this so you can kind of get an idea. Do that better.
At the center, Dylan opens a large wooden trunk. It's one of several stacked on top of each other. They belong to Manongs and Manongs who've passed away. This one is owned by a Manong named Eusebio Maglente.
So you can see like shoes and hangers. We found his wallet, belts. This catalog, a baseball catalog, for like, you can buy a mitt or balls or baseball bats, right? I think they were trying to start up their own Filipino team, baseball team.
Awesome, from 1923. The trunk holds bits and pieces of Eusebio's life. There are pay stubs, a portrait, suits, and letters. Lots of letters. Written in Visayan from people back home.
So it's kind of like this Manong was coming for the dead, telling his story, right? And it was very beautiful, you know. Sadly, as we did research, we know that he never married. We found his plot at a cemetery in French Camp, which is a neighboring small town of Stockton. It took over a month after his death for someone to purchase a plot for him. And so what that tells us is that he had no family.
Instead of going to school or chasing the American dream, the Manongs end up in stoop labor jobs, with low wages and poor working conditions. And they face a lot of racism and discrimination. In Stockton, people of color aren't allowed to cross Main Street into the richer, whiter sections of the city. Hotels and businesses openly display signs that say, "Positively no Filipinos allowed." Officials call Little Manila Skid Row, and it's next to other ethnic enclaves like Chinatown and Japantown. Manong spend their time in gambling dens, pool halls, and cockfights as outlets for their frustrations in America. Filipino women don't migrate in large numbers until much later because of cultural values about the woman's place being at home. So the Manongs live in bachelor societies. They go to brothels and taxi dance halls where men pay 10 cents to dance with women, who are usually white. But having relationships with any kind of woman is challenging for the Manungs, who often work migratory seasonal jobs. Anti-miscegenation laws make it illegal for Filipinos to marry white women, let alone socialize with them. And white guys, they don't like people of color around white women. When the Great Depression hits in 1929, poor whites blame Filipinos for taking their jobs. Racial tensions are high. When a Filipino-owned taxi dance hall opens in Watsonville, California, in January 1930, hundreds of armed, mostly white men hunt down Filipinos in the streets. They're robbed, beaten, and shot. 22-year-old Firmin Tobera is shot and killed. His murder is never solved. Violence spreads to other cities up and down California, like San Francisco and San Jose. In Stockton, the Filipino Federation building is bombed. The Healdsburg Tribune reports that, quote, whites in an automobile hurled a bomb into the building, blowing the facade clear across the street and throwing occupants of the club from their beds. I came here to learn about the vandalism that took place at this community center and how it affected the people here. I ended up learning about their ancestors, the pioneers, the Manung generation. Looking around the room, seeing what they had to go through, a few torn up posters and a little chicken scratch doesn't seem like such a big deal, right? I finally get a chance to ask Dylan what he thinks about the vandalism. What was his initial reaction? Why'd they keep the torn banners up? And why didn't they clean off the writing on the wall? When we spoke on the phone a few weeks ago, he told me he was actually kind of glad this happened. Why?
You want to know the truth? I kind of always expected something like this to happen. I mean, if you look at history, you know, Filipinos have always been kind of hated on, specifically locally.
Right. So when this happened, why was it kind of almost a positive thing?
Well, one, no one got hurt. No one was getting deported. End of the day, it's just some banners that can be easily replaced. It's just money. The other thing, too, is that I thought it was important that the Filipino community understand that they are not exempt from the issues of race that our nation is facing today. The idea of Nazis, you know, the resurgence of Nazis and what's happened in Charlottesville. You know, what side do we choose as a people? Are we just going to continue and try to appropriate white privilege, right? Or are we going to stand with our brothers and sisters who we stood with during the formation of the United Farm Workers for social justice and equality? Because that's really our heritage. That's really what should define us as a people. The only reason it wouldn't define us as a people is if we forget that.
I contacted the Stockton Police Department. They said there was an investigation into the vandalism at the Little Manila Center. There was a suspect, a white female adult, who appeared to be homeless. But they never identified her, and the case was ultimately closed. It was never classified as a hate crime. But some people still think it is. Regardless of who did it and why, it happened. And it meant something to Dylan and his community. Okay, so some of you might ask, why all this history? Why now? And I think it has a lot to do with what the Little Manila Center does. It's part of Little Manila Rising, a community organization that provides all kinds of services to Stockton's Filipino-American community, from education to the arts. They also fight for the historic preservation of the streets their ancestors once roamed, what is now officially called the Little Manila Historic Site. While working on this story, Dylan put me in touch with his co-founder, Don Boholano Mabalon, a professor and historian who, like Dylan, was born and raised in Stockton. We emailed and I hoped to meet and interview her one day, but she passed away suddenly this summer. Her book, Little Manila's in the Heart, was an important part of my research. In the flood of tributes to her, it was clear she inspired others to know their history, no matter how ugly or painful some of these truths might be. And I think that's why I went to Stockton, to learn about what happened in the past and present. In her book, Dawn wrote, Though the buildings are gone and the old-timers have passed away, the power and promise of the Little Manila community remains in the hearts of every Filipina or Filipino who remembers and reclaims its legacy. On the next episode, we'll learn more about that legacy. What happened to the Manons? And what is the future of Little Manila? This story was written, mixed, and produced by me, Paula Mardo. Co-producer and voice actor is Patrick Ipino. Cover art is by Selena Calma, with title design by me. Theme song is by Sea Light and the Prisms. Music in this episode is by Pedro Concepcion, Julian Felipe, Diane Key, James I. Lent, Lee Rosevere, and
Pavement.
Special thanks to everyone who provided feedback and support in the making of this episode. That's Katrina Alarcon, Joe Bernardo, Jacriza Cabrera, Girly Colado, Elaine Dolales, Renee Gross, Josie Huang, James Kim, Nick Liao, Erica Mu, Joel Kizon, Stephanie Southa, Ada Seng, David Weinberg, Visual Communications, and my family. I want to share scenes from the next episode with you. But first, thanks so much for listening. Seriously, it means a lot. If you like what you listen to, please subscribe to Long Distance Podcast. You can do this on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or head to longdistanceradio.com to learn more. If you really dig Long Distance, and I hope you do, please tell your friends. Follow the show on Instagram at Long Distance Radio, and join me on the Facebook group, Long Distance Radio Club. Now, on the next episode of Long Distance.
It's unfortunate that it happened, but the silver lining behind this vandalism or this hate crime even is that people started paying attention. People started thinking like, oh, there's a center in downtown that's dedicated to like Filipino-American history and art. Like, what is that?
That's next time on Long Distance. See you next month on the 15th. Thanks for listening.